I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Randy Cohen, best known as the ethicist from the pages of the New York Times Magazine, and the author of the new book, Be Good. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. The Jewish holidays are finally in our rearview mirror, and what a long, adventurous trip it has been. From Slichot, the week before Rosh Hashanah, through the Jewish New Year, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, followed by Sukkot, the Tabernacles, Festival of Thanksgiving, then Shmini Atzeret, and finally Simchat Torah this last week. A full 30-day ride through holidays serious, celebratory, and finally raucous. It's fun but challenging, a kind of religious marathon for all observant Jews, Reform, Conservative, or Orthodox. But for those of us who serve as cantors or rabbis or both, it's more like an ultra triathlon. We manage it every year, but the net result by this time, for all of us who labor in the gardens of the service of the Lord, as it were, is a kind of collective spiritual exhaustion. And as usual, Judaism has the necessary tonic for this ailment. This week, we enter the Hebrew calendar month of Cheshvan, the second month of the Jewish year, and the only one that has exactly no holidays. In fact, its nickname is Mar Cheshvan, literally the bitter month, because there are no festivals at all. That means we can actually concentrate on the basic reality of living a good Jewish life with no additional holidays, prayers, or ritual observances to remember and do. All of which allows us to return our religious focus to the aspect of Judaism that is with us all year, the part of our tradition that constantly brings renewal and inspiration. It's the reading and chanting and most of all the study of Torah that provides refreshment for the soul at any and every season. And just in time for this holiday-free period, we're reading some of the most famous and dramatic sections of the Torah. We've gone back to the beginning and started again with Genesis, and we will be exploring this amazing text from the creation of the entire universe all the way through the stories of Noah, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the tale of Joseph, right up until the end of this calendar year in December. It's a great section of the greatest book ever written, and it certainly helps restore energy and meaning in the aftermath of the fall festival hangover. Yesterday, we began with the amazing portion of Genesis, the creation of the universe, as well as the great narrative of the Garden of Eden, and then the story of Cain and Abel, and a few other vignettes that have helped create our entire understanding of the world and served as the basis for religion, culture, art, and literature ever since. And this week, we chant the greatest sea story ever told, the great flood narrative of Noah, and then conclude with the Tower of Babel. It's an embarrassment of literary and religious riches, and it never fails to provoke new ideas, insights, and approaches that enliven and enrich our lives. But some old favorites do need to be brought back annually. For example, there's a great song from a forgotten Broadway show on the theme of Noah called Two by Two, starring the late Danny Kaye. It's about what happens when you finally get off the ark, a delightful song called When It Dries.
Why are you so gloomy? We're alive and we're afloat. After 40 days and nights, it's shipshape on the boat. Look, the sun's come out again and turned a rosy red. How can you be gloomy when you think of what's ahead? It's gonna be some terrific place when it dries, when it dries. You're gonna see wide and open space when it dries, when it dries. It's gonna be some terrific place. You're gonna see wide and open space. We're gonna have such a human race when it dries. The greenery's gonna have a shine when it dries.
When it dries!
The world'll be full and fat and fine when it dries.
When it dries!
The greenery's gonna have a shine. The world'll be full and fat and fine.
The best thing of all, it's one third mine.
Half a million growing things will spring up from the ground.
Half a million bodies will be floating all around.
Room to work and grow and build a company of men.
Think about how much we can contaminate again.
There's gonna be air beyond compare when it dries.
When it dries.
With drinkable water everywhere.
When it dries. When it dries. There's gonna be air beyond compare with drinkable water everywhere.
As long as you don't have people there when it dries.
When it dries.
When it dries. Survive, we'll all live side by side in peace, caring for the animals and watching them increase.
Isn't it a miracle? A brand new world begins.
Think of all the fun we'll have
inventing brand new sins.
We're going to walk a righteous path when it dries. Remembering how he vents his wrath when it dries. We're going to walk a righteous path. Remembering how he vents his wrath.
That when he got mad, we took some bath.
When it dries.
The song When It Dries from the old musical 2x2 with music by one of the most successful Broadway composers, Richard Rodgers. Of course, Rodgers was Jewish, and his most famous partners were the Jewish guy Lorenz Hart and the descended from but not raised Jewishly Oscar Hammerstein. In any case, the great tale of Noah is shared to one degree or another by other ancient books of lore and legend, most notably the Sumerian Epic of Gilgamesh, another man who had to build a big boat to save humanity. But rather than read to you an ancient Akkadian, which I know you would enjoy, but I thought that Bill Cosby's version of the Noah story would play better.
You see, Noah was in his rec room sawing away. He was making a few things for the home there. He's a good carpenter. Vuba, 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 vuba. Noah. Somebody call? Vuba, vuba, vuba. Noah. Who is that? It's the Lord, Noah. Right. Where are you? What do you want? I've been good. I want you to build an ark. Right. What's an ark? Get some wood, build it 300 cubits by 80 cubits by 40 cubits. Right. What's a cubit? Let's see, a cubit. I used to know what a cubit was. Well, don't worry about that, Noah. When you get that done, go out into the world, collect all of the animals in the world by twos, male and female, and put them into the ark. Right.
That was Bill Cosby on Noah. There's just something inherently comic about being stuck on a big boat with a large number of animals. But it's also a great opportunity to see ourselves in these inherently comic yet serious situations. Ever wonder what to do when confronted with an ethical dilemma in your own life? Our delightful guest this morning is the ultimate expert on this subject, or at least he wrote answers to those kinds of questions for many years for the New York Times Magazine. Find out the answers to all of your moral quandaries when we return with Randy Cohen, the ethicist, here on Too Jewish. Or is it unethical for me to oversell his abilities? I wonder.
Hi, Joe Spina of Mama's Pizza. The other day I was writing up copy for a poster that shows Mama's new feature of the month. It's called Chicken Alfredo Pasta. This is what I wrote. Our Chicken Alfredo Pasta is fresh chicken breast sautéed in olive oil with al dente rotini pasta smothered in our signature Alfredo sauce and seasoned with our imported grated Italian Parmesan cheese. It's served with your choice of garlic toast or bread. Mangiamo. Now, the word mangiamo means eat up in Italian. And believe me, once you see our chicken Alfredo pasta, you'll definitely want to mangiamo. At Mama's, we're always trying to create delicious, unique, and value-priced entrees, appetizers, and desserts. Of course, our pizzas and calzones are always a favorite, but we hope you'll be adventurous and try some of our other great selections, too. I know they'll make you feel meraviglioso, which of course means wonderful. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Randy Cohen, the ethicist, as he is best known, American writer and humorist. He wrote for the New York Times Magazine from 1999 to 2011. The column was syndicated throughout North America. He's also the author of several books, a playwright, and the host of a public radio show called Person, Place, Thing. Randy was born in Charleston, South Carolina, went to graduate school at Cal Arts in Southern California, and graduated from the University of Albany SUNY with a Bachelor of Arts in Music, none of which seems, frankly, to relate to what you actually do. Tell us a little bit about your work and how you became the ethicist.
The necessary precursor was to be a very, very bad composer. I studied composition in graduate school, and it was quite late in that process that I realized I had no musical gifts of any kind. I simply didn't think musically. I realized this is a bit of self-knowledge any 12-year-old would have had, but somehow I missed it. And I just wasn't sure what to do with myself when I moved to New York, where I'd always wanted to live, and gradually made my way as a writer, something much more appropriate. I grew up in a house where people spoke. So that was more compatible, and that led me to writing mostly humor pieces for newspapers and magazines, and then eventually for the Letterman show and some other shows. And so it was as much a surprise to me as anyone else when the Times invited me to audition for the ethicist job. It was an in-house idea. The editors of the magazine conceived it and invited, I don't know, they're very secretive or very discreet, depending on your perspective, maybe a dozen people to try out for this job. And we each got the same three questions, very much the sort of thing that runs in the column. How they chose me remains an enigma. My guess is clerical error, and they hate admitting that sort of thing.
Well, I understand that because, you know, admission of error is an ethical challenge. You are also credited as the inventor of the top 10 list on David Letterman.
Yes, by Dave himself. I was deeply gratifying to I believe said that to Regis. No higher court than Dave talking to Regis.
Dave talking to Regis Philbin, my goodness.
as for many ideas, the reality is slightly more complex, that very few ideas, I think, spring fully formed from their creators' heads. And this was one of those that, as I recall it, and you know, whenever that phrase introduces a conversation, you can just hang up and give up. But as I recall it, I had seen something in Cosmo called The 10 Sexiest Men Over 60, and I was just hanging about the office chatting about this to my colleagues. This seemed an incredibly amusing idea back when I was, 41. Now that I'm 64, it doesn't seem so funny. So we were sort of we weren't trying to work. We were just hanging around the reception room before the working day officially began, and people were cracking wise about this and suggesting other sort of funny lists. And as I recall it then, it was our producer, Bob Morton, who said, oh, we should do something like that for the show. And I just went, oh, I saw exactly what it should be then, and then pitched it to the head writer. So, you know, if I hadn't read it and the other writers weren't there goofing around and Morty hadn't kind of crystallized what we'd all just said, who knows?
You know, someone less ethical would have just taken credit for it and gone on.
One of the things that was wonderful about the show was how little of that fighting for credit there was. Everyone was so happy to be there. Everyone was cooperative. There was a feeling that the show was insatiable. I mean, we were doing then, I guess, 4 shows a week, and we were responsible, we the writers, for 2 pieces on every show. I mean, and the rejection rate was breathtaking. It was like 90% of what you would submit would never appear on the show. So we were so grateful when anyone had something that could be used.
Thank
so we could
God,
all go
we
home
could,
and see our loved ones.
We got it
that,
done.
That there was none of that quibbling about credit, which made it possible to collaborate with other people, to help one another. Steve O'Donnell was the name of the head writer of the show, and I think he created that atmosphere. No simple thing to do. To get 10 people to help one another. I mean, writers, edgy and nervous and depressed, but not competitive on the show.
You know, the edgy and nervous and depressed just sounds Jewish, but we will come back and talk much more with Randy Cohen, the ethicist. His new book is just out. It's called Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything, and we'll be back soon on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442. Again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio, or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows by streaming them from the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Here's our weekly 2012 presidential election campaign Jewish moment. They're counting the Jews. An American Jewish Committee survey of Jewish voters in Ohio, a battleground state, has the community favoring President Obama in similar numbers to polls elsewhere. The survey released last week by the AJC has Ohio's Jews voting for Obama 64% to 29% for Mitt Romney, the Republican. With a 6.4% margin of error, the numbers are commensurate with two other AJC polls last month that had Obama beating Romney 69 to 25% among Florida Jewish voters and 65 to 24% nationally. This would mark a slight drop-off on Obama's Jewish numbers of 4 years ago, when he garnered 78% of the Jewish vote. As in those polls, the economy and health care topped Jewish voters' concerns. And that was our campaign 2012 Jewish election moment. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Good morning, Guy. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov, Rabbi. How are you?
I'm well. Well, now that the holidays are past, we can focus on the great Israeli sport of elections. In America, we are very focused. Every 4 years, the president gets elected. It's a big deal. In Israel, it seems like they have elections about every 8 minutes sometimes. But this government's been particularly long-lasting. They're only calling elections a year early. Can you explain how that works?
Yeah, the system in Israel is quite different than in the United States. In Israel, people vote for a political party, and the parties are going into the House, into the Knesset, which is the Israeli parliament. After the elections, the head of the biggest party in the Knesset will be the one forming the government. Basically, each Knesset members is supposed to go to the president of Israel, and the president in Israel is a more symbolic thing, as he doesn't have real authorities. The main authority he does have is that the president is the one to assign the next prime minister after the election. And the way he's doing it, he needs to get Knesset members to recommend who will be the prime minister, and once he have over 60 Knesset members, which is over 50% of the House, recommending a certain person, that person is giving a two-week period to build a government and a coalition. This coalition was built by Bibi Netanyahu, and he was actually the head of the second large party and not the biggest party. The biggest party, Tzipi Livni, was not able to get enough Knesset members to recommend her for the position of a prime minister. So Bibi was giving the right. And now we are told that the elections would be set early, a year early, and they're planned to take place on January 15th. And the way it is set, once the Knesset decides that they no longer support the government, the Knesset can vote and define a new time for elections. That's one way of throwing out the prime minister and setting a new election. The other way is for the prime minister to come and say, I no longer want to serve in this Knesset, and I want to do a new election. This is the case in this time. Bibi is the one coming and saying, let's go for a new election. We can only assume that he's doing it because he believes that he will win more votes in the upcoming elections, which will give him more power within the parliament, within the Knesset, to do whatever his government is planning on doing, whether it's different laws, economy, or security needs.
You know, it's interesting. Usually prime ministers call elections when they can't get their budget through, or they, you know, have lost a vote of confidence, or if they think it's a big advantage. Does Netanyahu see this as an opportunity to increase the list of Likud members this time?
I guess that's part of the story. The other part is that there is a very big issue for Netanyahu currently with the ultra-Orthodox community, as the Supreme Court have ruled that the law, the tradition that exempts ultra-Orthodox boys from serving in the military is not legal and cannot be continued. And now he would need to face the need to create a new law. In history, most prime ministers that try to touch all of that area of the laws that are regarding the ultra-Orthodox community weren't able to continue to maintain their power as a prime minister because of the ultra-Orthodox religious parties that were always against any change of those laws. So it seems that Bibi knows, Prime Minister Netanyahu knows that at this point this will be a significant issue and he won't be able to avoid it for very long. The other side is, of course, the economical recession that is starting to show more and more signs in Israel. I just talked today with some friends in Israel that told me that the prices of vegetables have jumped really high, and today a tomato in Israel would cost you something like $3 for a kilo of tomatoes, $4, which is very high compared to the prices normally in Israel, or cucumbers that rose to a price of $2.50 in Israel, where usually you would pay a half dollar for cucumbers. So people do feel the recession, and that's another stress that comes in the prime minister's direction.
Thanks. We will talk much more. Thanks for illuminating Israeli politics for us, Guy.
Thank you very much. Have a great week.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, last week we started talking about Chabad, also called Lubavitch, the ultra-Orthodox group that uses all kinds of modern technology and has been very outreach-oriented. Thought I might give a little bit of a background on that, and then we can talk about their work, particularly in Eastern Europe and Central Europe that we covered a little bit last week.
But great.
Chabad is, you know, like so many Hasidic sects, you have to say that word carefully, a hierarchical kind of hereditary descendant of the Schneerson family, the first great Chabad rabbi. Chabad stands for Chochmah Bina Dea, three great principles, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. It's very much in the line of many other Hasidic groups with some very fine literature exploring Judaism in mystical ways. But Chabad in particular embraced the concept of joy, the Simcha Shel Mitzvah. And in the immediate aftermath of the Holocaust, most of the Lubavitchers were gone because the Eastern European Center was gone. What was left were the Jews in primarily New York. On the ashes of that, Chabad redesigned itself under the Rabbi Schneerson, may he rest in peace, his leadership, into a very outreach-oriented group that went out and decided they were going to spread Judaism among Jews wherever they could, everywhere in the world. And from a very small group, they've become most likely the largest Hasidic group in the world, certainly the most influential with all of the rest of the Jewish world, and very active in places where nobody else is active. I don't know, I've personally seen them in Marrakesh, I've seen them in the ghetto of Venice, I've seen them in Sydney, Australia, and I'm sure you've seen them lots of other places too.
Well, absolutely. I mean, but I think it's one thing to be present where there is a historic Jewish presence like Marrakesh, or a huge contemporary Jewish presence like Sydney, Australia, where there's lots of types of Judaism and Jewish communal institutions. It's quite another to be present in a place where there's no historic Jewish presence like Thailand or Nepal, where one of the main functions of Chabad, as far as I can tell, is to provide venues for young Israelis who travel mostly post-army to spend a traditional Pesach or Yom Kippur or celebrate some Jewish holiday in, which they might or might not do at home. But in Eastern Europe, in the former Soviet Union, I think Chabad has done something particularly important and particularly difficult, which is they've ducked the question of who's a Jew halachically or biologically, or who has a Jewish education. It's anybody who wants to come and eat should come and eat. And all we want to get you to do is like one thing more than you're already doing. So if you're doing nothing, kiss the mezuzah on the way in. If you're doing something, add something to it. Like put on tefillin once. You don't have to do it every day. And so it's very appealing and very open at the same time. And I think that there's no sort of pledge of allegiance required, which makes it pretty open-ended, in my experience, at least in Eastern and Central Europe, and particularly in the former Soviet Union, where people really had no level of practice whatsoever.
So it's a chance for Jews to come into Judaism. It's an entry level, even though it's Orthodoxy, which you think would be less accessible. They've found ways to make it more accessible. I think all branches of Judaism have learned a lot from Chabad and still could learn a few things.
Right.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A rabbi is lonely, needs some company at home, so he decides to buy a parrot. But of course, he wants to be sure the parrot is a suitable pet for a very proper rabbi to have in his home. "Are you sure it doesn't scream, yell, or swear?" the rabbi asks the pet store owner. "Oh, absolutely," the owner assures him. "In fact, this is a very special parrot. It was owned by a religious man. He taught him how to daven, how to pray." "Really?" says the rabbi. "How does that work?" "Well," says the pet shop owner, "you see the strings on his legs? You pull the right one, he says, Shema Yisrael. You pull the left one, he prays the whole Amida." "Wonderful," says the rabbi, "but what happens when you pull both strings?" "I fall off the perch, you schmuck," screeches the parrot. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special featured to Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and stay on that perch. And now a word of Torah. It's an old story, and we know it well. God sees that wickedness and corruption have spread throughout the world, and human beings are acting in ways that should have been predictable to an all-knowing deity. Lying, cheating, stealing, committing adultery, selling off a company's assets to take a big profit, the usual. In response, God decides to destroy the world in a great flood, rain falling for 40 days and nights, the whole of humanity drowned in deluge. One man is chosen to survive the flood because the Torah text tells us he was righteous in his generation. Noah, Noach in Hebrew, is chosen to carry the banner of humanity to the next generation. Gathering his family about him and two of each animal, plus seven pairs of each kosher animal, so there's something to eat and something to sacrifice to God if they make it, Noah builds the ark, loads the boat, goes on not a three-hour cruise, but one long enough to float away every trace of the depravity of humanity. Eventually, he sends out first a raven, and then finally a dove, to see if the world is dry enough to land on. The dove, that's a fancy word for pigeon, brings back that famous olive branch. They land and exit the ark, and life begins again. A great covenant is affirmed, the first and most enduring breach in human history. God agrees never again to destroy the earth by flood, and we agree to abide by certain minimum standards of morality. It's truly a new beginning. In essence, God acknowledges that this new world will not be the Garden of Eden anymore, but it can be both physically and morally good and rich. Noah, we are told, was a righteous man in his generation, which doesn't necessarily make him a righteous man in every generation, but it does set a reasonable standard that we can live up to. If we can't succeed in becoming fully righteous for all time, at least we can strive to be righteous in our own turbulent times. All that's required is we try to be the best we personally can be, seeking to be moral and good when we choose to be so. If we can do that and choose to be better than Noah, or maybe not even much, we too might end up saving the world. Our Jewish Poetry Slam this week comes from poet Jane Shore. She tells the story of the flood from the perspective of the Ark, a modern Ark. On the avenue below, they file past two and two, two and two, and are recorded. Men and women climb the ramp and enter my body to be welcomed as Eve welcomed Adam, who bore her and broke him. Uninjured by her departure, and the children, each with his small grief, and the animals, each with his complaint, issue from the planet that would keep its strict count. Male and female he made them, beasts unlinked by gender. Monstrous or innocent, they fill me, who will carry them to safety. And now the dove, now circling the tree, once circled this wilderness inside me, an instrument meant to receive life and not to judge it. That was Jane Shore's poem about Noah, but called The Ark. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Randy Cohen, the ethicist, will explain how he came to be the expert on solving everyone's moral dilemmas. It's a surprising story. Hear it when we come back on Too Jewish in a moment.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The U.S. military has secretly sent a task force of about 150 planners and other specialists to Jordan to help the armed forces of Jordan handle a flood of Syrian refugees, prepare for the possibility that Syria will lose control of its chemical weapons, and to be positioned should the turmoil in Syria expand into a wider conflict. The task force, which is led by a senior American military officer, is based at a Jordanian military training center built into an old rock quarry north of Amman. It is now largely focused on helping Jordanians handle the estimated 180,000 Syrian refugees who have crossed the border into Jordan and are severely straining the country's limited resources. American officials familiar with the operation say the mission also includes drawing up plans to try to insulate Jordan, an important American ally, from the upheaval in Syria and to avoid the kind of clashes now occurring along the border between Syria and Turkey. Officials also said the idea of establishing a buffer zone between Syria and Jordan, which would be enforced by Jordanian troops on the Syrian side of the border and supported politically and maybe logistically by the U.S., has been discussed. But at this point, the buffer is just a contingency. The Obama administration has declined to intervene in the Syrian conflict beyond providing communications equipment and other non-lethal assistance to the rebels who oppose the government of President Bashar al-Assad. But the outpost near Amman could play a broader role should American policy change. It's less than 35 miles from the Syrian border. It's the closest American military presence to the conflict. In other news, it's not often that physics makes big headlines, but it happened twice last week. First, a letter in which Albert Einstein dismissed the idea of God as a product of human weakness is being sold on eBay for $3 million. The letter, handwritten back in 1954, a year before Einstein died, was addressed to philosopher Eric Goodkind. In it, in addition to his positive views about God, Einstein discussed his views on religion more generally, calling the Bible a collection of honorable but still primitive legends, which are nevertheless pretty childish. An anonymous collector who bought the letter in 2008 put it on sale at eBay. Eric Gazin, a spokesman for the sale, said, "With the interest in Einstein, along with the questions this letter touches on, we feel it is well worth the price." Ken O'Hara. And the 2012 Nobel Prize for Physics was shared by Serge Roche, a French-Jewish physicist, and David Wineland of the U.S. The Nobel Prize went to these scientists for groundbreaking experimental methods that enable measuring and manipulation of individual quantum systems, the website of the Nobel Prize said. A pair of scientists developed solutions to pick, manipulate, and measure photons and ions individually, allowing insight into the microscopic world that was once just the province of scientific theory. Haroche, born 68 years ago in Casablanca, Morocco, said that he had a hard time understanding the news when a representative of the Nobel Prize Committee called him on his cell phone. He won the highest form of recognition for scientific excellence. Dr. Roche of the College of France and the École Normale Supérieure will share a $1.2 million grant from the Nobel Prize Committee with Wineland, a researcher at the Maryland-based National Institute of Standards and Technology and at the University of Colorado. Roche was walking with his wife down the street when the call came from the Nobel people in Sweden. He had to sit down on a bench before he passed the news to his family. Richard Prosquier, the president of the Umbrella Organization of French Jewish Communities, said, "The achievement belongs to the scientists, but a small part of me is also proud today. Me too." Prosquier noted that Roche had worked closely with Claude Cohen-Tanouji, also a French Jew from North Africa, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1997. Cohen-Tanouji, who is 79 years old, is still an active researcher in Paris. Roche and Wineland beat out the God particle physicists for the Nobel Prize this year. Impressive. In other Jewish Nobel news, Robert Lefkowitz, a Jewish physician and path-breaking biochemist from New York, has won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, jointly with Brian Kobilka, a researcher at California's Stanford University. The Nobel Prize in Chemistry 2012 went to these scientists for groundbreaking discoveries that reveal the inner workings of an important family of receptors, G-protein-coupled receptors. If they say so. Understanding how these receptors function help further explain how cells sense their environments. Lefkowitz, who works at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute of Duke University, and Kobilka worked together to isolate and analyze a gene which led them to discover that the receptor was similar to one in the eye that captures light. There's a whole family of receptors that look alike and function in the same manner, the Nobel Prize people said. Lefkowitz will share a $1.2 million grant from the Nobelians with Kobilka. By the way, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2011 went to Dan Shechtman of Israel's Technion. To recap, this means that while Jews make up 0.25% of all the people on the planet, we have now won about 23% of all Nobel Prizes, including winning or sharing the last 3 in physics and 4 of the last 5 in chemistry. Mazel tov. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Randy Cohen, best known as the author of the Ethicist column. Well, I guess he's called the Ethicist in New York Times Magazine, which he wrote for something like 12 or 13 years. He has a new book out called Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything. His first book on the subject was called The Good, the Bad, and the Difference, How to Tell Right from Wrong in Everyday Situations. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You shared 3 Primetime Emmy Awards for Outstanding Writing. We were talking about the Letterman Show, which you created or co-created or organically co-created the top 10 list for, which everybody has used. By the way, do you get royalties on that?
None. No. I get royalties for the show.
That's good.
Every now and then. But it's been a while since I've worked there. But every now and then a check comes through for like $1.85, you know, when a show I worked on, you know, has now run, you know, in Somalia. Yeah. And the Writers Guild does make sure I get my $1.85.
My dad was a writer on the Cisco Kids series, and we'd get royalty checks like in the 1980s for 83 cents.
Cisco and Poncho. I used to watch that show. That was a wonderful show.
I will.
Oh, Cisco. Oh, Poncho. contact.
He will hear this, so I appreciate that.
Oh, no, it's genuinely, man, I really enjoyed that show. And I always thought, well, I'd like to find out. I always thought Sisko and Pancho were in some sense based on Don Quixote and Sancho Panza.
Kind of. I don't think TV was quite as grand as that in those days, at least not from my dad's descriptions, but I will ask him that question.
But I thought the show, I mean, it wasn't necessary that you knew that to watch the show, but I thought their relationship had something of that. I mean, Sisko was more, he lived in the real world in a way Don Quixote didn't, but the little chubby comic foil.
Leo Carrillo is the guy who played him.
Ah, man, that was a good show.
I'm glad to take you back. Let's ask, how does it feel to be the ethicist, and do you ever draw on Jewish background in making those kinds of decisions?
It was very daunting to get the job, that I felt I would give bad advice and someone would get hit by a bus. And I gradually came to think that no one would ever do anything I said, that I had a different role.
God, you now know what a rabbi feels like. What was the most difficult question you got as the ethicist?
Well, I thought they were all difficult, at least the easy ones weren't worth taking up. I thought they would just bore the reader if the answer seemed too obvious. So I tried not to do those and stuck with the ones that were a little more challenging that often required persistent thought before I could work out right conduct. Oh, can I go back to something?
Of course.
What were my responses Jewish in some sense? Or did they draw on Jewish moral thought? Not explicitly. That I'm, you know, I grew up in a Reform Jewish household, and I was bar mitzvahed, and I was confirmed.
So was that at KK Beth Elohim in Charleston?
It was not.
Okay.
We moved from Charleston to Reading, Pennsylvania when I was still quite young.
Ah.
And so that was in Oheb Shalom, was the name of our congregation.
Sure.
Subsequent to my confirmation, I don't think I've been in a synagogue, except for other people's commemorations, you know, joyful and sad.
So I
lead a kind of very secular life, and in the column I was resolutely secular in my approach. And yet, even as I say that, I was often struck by how seldom I took a position that deviated from the kind of moral thinking I grew up on. That I think you can take the boy out of the shul, but when you get as small or young, Rabbi. And you know, this is the first body of organized moral thought most people see. It's the religious training they receive. I very seldom differed from that, at least from the kind of Reform Judaism I grew up on, which had a notion of social justice and a belief in an egalitarian society.
And while not explicitly
Jewish, I thought, I only occasionally wrote something that the Jewish community, as personified by my mother, would take issue with.
With electronic media, the ability that people have to plagiarize, can you plagiarize yourself?
No, it's not plagiarizing, although it's a different kind of transgression that often, if you're a writer and you're providing a piece for a newspaper or magazine, one of the things the publisher expects is that this hasn't run before. They're buying something new. And so I trust you're alluding to Joan Allaire, who's recently been in trouble for this kind of thing.
Yeah, among many others.
Yeah,
you know,
many writers have done it.
Stephen Ambrose did it. I mean, a lot of other people
have
done it.
Yeah, so that the publisher reasonably expects that you're giving them some new stuff. You're not giving them shtick. You're not just recycling old stuff. And so that's not plagiarizing, but it's something else. It's something that you shouldn't do. And it's a lesser transgression in my view. I guess in the view of most editors, too. A transgression, but a lesser one. That what one ought to do is say, oh, this is based on something I wrote before. Do you still want it? That you have to be transparent with the publisher. And then it's fine.
So if a rabbi plagiarizes himself in a sermon...
If you're doing a whole other sermon, you're doing like your greatest hits, you should let them know.
By the way, I once said 11 years ago, when you never heard it in another congregation, that would be the appropriate ethical approach.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I think so. You know, I got a surprising amount of mail
Not that I would ever do that. I just want to make that
clear. I don't think it's such a bad thing. As long as you let them know, you'd say like, "Oh, here was something I spoke about." Like, especially if it's, you know, it's your Shavuot sermon that you wrote a particularly good one, and that the congregation really responded to it. And 5 years later, you thought, "Oh, these people sitting here might not have heard it or might not remember it. And I want to do it again." I think that's wonderful. Just let them know.
Absolutely.
I got a lot of mail from people who of various faiths telling me that their clergyman had plagiarized a sermon. There are websites called like sermon.com.
Oh, yeah.
You can go online and get a sermon. And you know, this is a... Okay, so we know this is terrible. You can't take credit for someone else's work, obviously. And you can't deceive the congregation into thinking you wrote this thing and you didn't. Also obvious. What struck me was how hard a profession you have, that you're asked to do this impossible set of tasks that few of us can do any of them, and you're supposed to do all of them. You're supposed to be a spellbinding orator when you deliver the sermon, a brilliant writer when you conceive it, an administrator who must run this kind of small business that is any congregation, a psychologist. How you do this is amazing. And so... frankly, a lot of clergy turn out to be deficient at some of these tasks, and especially writing.
Not me, of course, but
not
but
you,
other
no.
clergy,
and right. Certainly not Jews, for people of the book. But there are clergy I have heard who may be brilliant at all these other tasks, but are not good writers. So, and in the 19th century. You know, books of sermons were bestsellers. It was a popular literary form. So why would as a congregant, if I were sitting there, I would much rather hear my clergyman deliver the brilliant sermon written by someone else and let me know. You know, here's Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail. I'm going to deliver that today.
That's
and then
a good
we'll
sermon.
Discuss it.
That's a good sermon.
It would be great. It would be great. But I gather, you know, your co-professionals are forbidden to do this. That's kind of
against the rules. You're right. You know, I'm so glad that you understand our profession. That is probably the most beautiful and succinct and positive description of the challenge of being a clergy. And it's obviously not just Jewish. It's the same all around. You missed your calling.
Well, no, I'm not saying I'd be good at anything. Oh, no, you can just come over to my house and, you know, have a beer after working, and I'll understand your heartache.
That sounds great. I want to thank Randy Cohen for a great visit. And by the way, you can come on Too Jewish anytime. That was
have me on again. It's fun talking.
I would love to. His book, which is out from Chronicle Books, is called "Be Good: How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything." And he's delightful. And where else can people find out about your stuff?
Well, you know, I'm on the Facebook. Book that the young people are so into. I've been working on this radio project. They can go to personplacething.org and hear my dulcet nasal tones in that format.
Randy, thanks a million. We'll get you back.
I'd like that.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan, on Too Jewish. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Professor John Davis, who wrote a fascinating book on a small Jewish community in Italy that has returned to Judaism after 400 years. Our playout this morning comes from the CD Lev Tahor. It's titled Cut, A Pure Heart, from the Israeli Reformed Jewish Band of Kehilat HaLev in Tel Aviv. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Lev tahor, brali Elohim, veruach nachon, chadesh bekirbi. אל תשליכני
מלפניך ורוח קודשך אל תיקח ממני לב טהור Al-Fatihah